underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Irvine Welsh returns to Edinburgh, the home of Trainspotting and so many of his novels since, with a new novel, A Decent Ride, featuring one of his most iconic and beloved characters, Juice Terry Lawson. The book is thick on the Scottish brogue, heavy on the filth, and pretty masterful in its comedic timing. Irvine Welsh is the author of Trainspotting, Ecstasy, Glue, Porno, Filth, The Acid House, and Reheated Cabbage, just to name a few. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Irvine Welsh to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What brought you to this particular story and ultimately back to one of your, I assume it's your one of your favorite characters, because it certainly is with readers, and that is Juice Terry Lawson.
Terry, yeah, he's always been a very interesting character to me. He's kind of, he knows what he wants out of life. It's pretty one-dimensional in certain ways, but he's basically a serial womanizer, and that's all he's interested in is sex and loads of sex. And I think when you have that kind of thing going on with you, when you have that one dimension, there's a certain kind of life, has a certain kind of simplicity. So it's quite attractive to write a character, a fictional character, who has just this very kind of very sort of one dimensional, one track view of the world. But it's also fun when things kind of mess up with them kind of meeting their objectives. So I've put Terry in this position where he can't get what he's used to getting and what he wants to get and what he needs to get. So he has to look at his life and kind of reconfigure it. To me, it was kind of very much a sort of a metaphor for the transformation that I've been seeing in Scotland since I've been going back. You know, the way that all the, you know, the politics is changing, the society is changing, and it's kind of, in some ways, it's kind of growing up, in some ways quite painfully, you know, as it's kind of making, kind of striding towards kind of sort of greater independence. And it's quite a kind of jarring, kind of painful process in a lot of ways. And I wanted a guide to kind of to navigate me through this, and I wanted it to be somebody who really wouldn't care that much about all the transitions that were happening in Scotland. I didn't want to use the independence referendum, so I wanted to use a metaphor for it, and I wanted to use a metaphor for the chaos and turbulence as the hurricane, that the first hurricane we'd had in Scotland, Hurricane Bobag, which was kind of about 2 or 3 years before the referendum. So I used that as a kind of a slightly kind of tongue-in-cheek metaphor for all the chaos and turbulence in Scottish society.
By doing that with someone, a character that does not care about those changes, of course indicates that you care very much about those changes.
Well, I mean, I think that it's interesting to me. I think it's like I see it as a sort of, it's a kind of universal thing that is, you know, that's happening. I mean, it's like everybody now, whether it's kind of Greece or whether it's even here in America, you know, candidates at least have to sort of, there's a big backlash against the establishment, against a kind of neoliberal kind of consensual establishment. And in some ways, Sanders, in other ways, kind of, even though it's kind of sort of, you know, it's masked in a kind of buffoonery, in some ways, Trump is kind of sort of, you know, is picked up on that kind of thing as well. But I think that this is happening right across the West. I think there's, you know, there's this idea that neoliberal kind of economics and politics have been seen to have failed people, and people are looking for the next thing. I think it goes hand in hand with all the turbulence in society. I mean, we've had massive changes. We seem to be moving away from a world of both capitalism and socialism. They seem to be kind of they seem to be finished by technology now. We seem to be kind of moving towards a more conceptualist society, the mode of production being, you know, information. And, you know, we're having to come to terms with the idea that we won't have paid employment, or we won't have a lot of paid employment to go around. And that's a massive thing. You know, it means that there's no consumers for capitalism. It means that there's no taxpayers for socialism to build a kind of social wealth. So we have to get our heads around that, basically. And I think that, you know, I'm always interested. I think every writer's interested in writing about a society that's in transition. And I think, you know, basically they all are now in the West.
When you consider what is at stake with these characters, and because you are dealing with characters who are so often, well, as the Times of London says, can be found in the toilet bowl, what does that say about, well, your interest in as a writer, and how much exploring you want to do of a class society and how people fit into that society?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, with the advance of neoliberal capitalism, you know, kind of, if you look to the Thatcher-Reagan era, I mean, it was basically the poor and kind of working class people who were kind of hit the hardest and continue to be kind of hit the hardest. But it's almost like they've been kind of decimated, and all the wealth is kind of, and you know, the common kind of wealth has been taken from them. And now it's middle class people, even kind of sort of very well to do, you know, kind of higher end middle class people that are under attack. And they're basically under attack because the whole system is now, it's designed to convert their assets into debt. So it principally does this through their kids. You know, the kids kind of now have to pay for all these college tuition fees. They take out all these loans. This is right across the Western world, particularly in Britain and America. And there are no, you know, they're doing retail jobs at the end of it. So they're not really sort of getting the opportunities, you know, so all the people are spending all their assets on their kids. And what happens eventually, is, of course, is that their kids inherit their homes, and the banks cash in the value for their homes from debt. So everything is transferred to the banks, basically, and the sort of the uber rich. I think there's going to be a big kind of fallout. I mean, I think education, big campuses, big educational institutions in Britain and America are going to be like these malls that you see, these ghost malls that have all closed down and there's kind of tumbleweed blowing around them. Because I just don't think that if you can't offer paid employment, you can only offer debt, then what becomes the point in kind of racking up all that sort of debt through the education system? The education system becomes a kind of bankers and politicians and sort of 1% or scam, basically, to convert your assets into debt. Mm. So I think eventually younger consumers, younger people are going to be voting with their feet and just not signing up. And, you know, I think eventually their parents are going to say, well, look, you know, we can send you to college for 3 years, but it's not going to do you any good. You know, do you want us to cash in our assets to do that? Because we'll do it, but we're just effectively giving it to the banks.
Irvine Welsh is our guest. The new novel is A Decent Ride. It is published by Doubleday. So let's go back to talking about Juice Terry Larson for a moment. He is a drug dealer, a gonzo porn star, a taxi driver, and ultimately, while he is shameless, he is also a decent fellow.
Yeah, I mean, I think he is basically a good guy. I don't think he doesn't really wish kind of harm on anybody. And he wants to, he's like most people, he just wants to get on with his life. He doesn't have any big kind of political designs and ambitions. And he wants to get on with his life. And like most people, he also finds it very difficult to get on with his life because, you know, because when you're in a kind of world that's in turbulence, you kind of really do have to start making decisions and you have to take a kind of position against your better nature, basically. And with Terry, it's basically his loss of libido that becomes the sort of, or his perceived loss of libido that becomes the kind of the governing factor in his personal change.
Yes. Will he be able to negotiate life after this terrible event robs him of his sexual virility?
Well, I mean, he tries all different things. I mean, he tries golf, which, I mean, a lot of people try that in the Western world. I mean, I mean, some people probably wish they had tried it, like Tiger Woods, perhaps, like, you know. He does that. He also gets into, it does another thing that that a lot of people do. He gets into books. so you know, he's trying all sorts of ways to survive without sex.
When you are writing, there has been, of course, and I believe we've discussed it when we've chatted in the past, and that is about the language. And at what point did it come to you from the very beginning of the language in these books of talking, writing as you speak, writing as the characters, as we would hear that, and in having your own style, even your own lexicon?
It was something that I kind of evolved when I was writing the first book. I tried to do it in standard English, and it just didn't work for me. You know, the characters didn't kind of think like that or speak like that or operate in that kind of way, you know, but it's the way we're taught to express ourselves. But I wanted to get a more kind of performative thing going on because I think it's partly to do with that kind of sort of Celtic kind of oral storytelling tradition that people tell stories, they don't write them down. But I wanted to get the kind of energy and the kind of performance that people use when they tell the stories actually on the page. And the best way I could do that was through kind of slang and street argot.
Do you ever worry that the reader has difficulty in understanding exactly what you're trying to convey?
I mean, I have difficulty in understanding exactly what I'm trying to convey. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, basically I do. I mean, it's like, I think none of us, doesn't matter who we are or where we're from, we're not really used to seeing words on a page in that way. So visually it looks very strange. And I mean, most people say that once they get past 20 pages, they get into the rhythm of it and, you know, the voices take over in their head and they're fine with it. But I think it is a kind of, you know, so in terms of as a writer, it's a massive strength because it gives you kind of an original voices, but and it helps to get you into a kind of culture. But it's also a kind of weakness in the sense that it's something that, you know, people kind of, people want instant sort of access to things, and they have to work a little bit, you know, for the first few pages, I think, to get into my books, or some of my books, the ones that are more kind of vernacular heavy than others.
Do you have to go back, when you're writing about Scotland, do you have to go back to fully appreciate and to get the sound of a novel? Do you ever lose it when you're, because you live in Chicago, that do you ever lose that sense, or does that never go away?
I think it seems to go away sometimes. I mean, I get, I listen to myself talk, you know, and even though now I sound, you know, very Scottish to American listeners, I feel it's, you know, for Scottish listeners, they would probably think it sounds very kind of phony and transatlantic. And I notice that when I go home, as soon as I get into the taxi, my accent changes completely and it becomes a lot thicker. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm lucky that I've got a place. I've still got a house in Edinburgh, and I get back maybe kind of 2 or 3 months every year, maybe about kind of 3 or 4 times a year. So, you know, I still feel pretty much immersed in it. I don't feel that it's like, I think it's, you experience exile very differently now, you know, with all kind of, you've got Skype and you've got all these means of kind of still keeping in touch with people. And obviously you've got, you know, I'm over so much that I don't really feel as if I'm kind of divorced from it, even though I'm not there kind of 9 months in the year.
When you write a book like you did last year of the sex lives of Siamese twins, and it took place in Miami South Beach, is there a different writing style in that, or is the writing for you?
I think it comes out of character, basically. You know, you have to try and find, you know, the voices of the character, and you find, you know, their cultural background, you know, the stuff they listen to, the TV shows they've watched and all that, the things that they've, you know, people they've gone to school with. And you try and get that as right as possible. And it doesn't really matter what that is. You know, the key is to try to work to get it as good as you can. the Scottish kind of, you know, what we call the more Scottish books, they actually take a bit more effort really than the American stuff, because you know the Americans. Characters are basically written in standard English. The difficulty therein, for me as a writer, lies in kind of in working out their backstories and working out sort of cultural things that I'm not familiar with, like all the TV programs we would have watched and growing up and all that, and all the places we would have went to, and you know, so that's the difficult part. Linguistically, the more difficult part is actually Scotland, because again, you know, you have to make these words. Or, you know, you have to kind of design these words on a page and make them kind of work in a very rhythmic way. So it takes, it usually takes more drafts if I'm doing a kind of a novel that's very vernacularly based. I mean, it's like, I know there's people that think that I just sit down there and have a couple of drinks and just fire it out in one take, but it doesn't work like that, I can assure you.
Because it is so much to the ear, do you read it? Do you have to read it out loud?
Yeah, I do everything. I read everything that I write out loud, and many, many times until it feels right for me. And I think that when it doesn't read right, or when somebody says, oh, I don't quite understand that bit, I mean, that's probably just a kind of bizarre tick in my brain rather than a sort of... rather than anything to do with it kind of being sort of not written correctly.
When you create that way, is there such a thing as not writing it correctly and not doing it correctly? Because it's your set of rules, ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is. I mean, it's like when I started writing, it was, you know, it's like when people try and satirize it, basically, it looks, you know, it reads, you know, it kind of reads really strange and really bad. You know, if a journalist will say, I'm going to review Irvin Welsh's book in his kind of words or his kind of style of writing, and it's always terrible. It's always really embarrassing, but probably not. You know, but probably not to them and their friends, but to anybody from Scotland, it would be really bad. It's difficult. It's difficult to hit every note exactly right, and I think you really have to give it a lot of. You have to have a good ear, but you have to be immersed in it to hit it just the right way.
And I would assume that it always sounds better coming out of your mouth, in the sense of especially when you're writing it, because it's also part of your brain.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a lot of read-throughs with actors for scripts and all that, you know, here and in England, and some people are just really good at it, though. You know, some people just really get that it's not so much about... It's not so much about the pronunciation of one or two words. It's about the rhythm of it. And one, you know, and I've had a lot of great actors in America that have done read-throughs on my stuff, and it's been fantastic because they've just found the rhythm of it. And they don't think of it as I'm going to do the fat guy from Groundskeeper Billy from The Simpsons, or the fat guy from Mike Myers's thing. You know, they just kind of get on with finding the rhythm of it and not get too hung up on sort of the kind of sort of shouty, kind of truculent Scottish pronunciations.
There is a rhythm to it. There is even a musicality. Does music play a role in the writing at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I like to make a playlist for every single character that I write, and that helps me find them, and it helps me find a kind of... as well as the rhythm to the story, I think every character's got a kind of rhythm, you know, the way they move, the way they sort of operate. You know, as I say, when people go into a pub in Scotland, they don't tell you a story, they kind of perform it. And, you know, Ireland's like that as well. Some parts of England are like that. Liverpool's very much like that, because there's a kind of a big Irish influence and kind of Celtic tradition there. But even some parts of the West Country have got all that kind of thing going on. And some of the big urban centres in England have got, you know, that kind of stuff going on too. So, I think that kind of, that rhythm and feel to it is just always kind of very crucial.
The book is pretty filthy, which I guess is also what readers expect from you at a certain point.
Yeah, it is, and I think I mean there's a lot of kind of sex scenes in it. There's a lot of really dark sex scenes in it, but I think you've got to make it about the characters. I think if you're writing something like that, you have to write them about character, and if it fits in terms of the character, it works out. I mean, there's a scene where the wee guy Jaunty is kind of you know, is basically having sex with the corpse of his girlfriend, which kind of seems like a horrible kind of thing to do. But if you make it just about sex, it is a horrible thing. But this is kind of more about. I think it's one of the saddest parts of the book. It's kind of it's a very pathos kind of drenched scene, because it's about him really trying to find her and trying to connect with her. And you know, he's not kind of all there. Basically, he's a bit slow. And he's trying to sort of connect with something that he lost, and I think that's why that scene really works. You know, it's much more emotionally disturbing than it is physically revolting, I think.
Mm. Do you worry about being physically revolting?
No, I've nothing against being physically revolting, but I think you have to have something else going on as well. You know, you can't just say I'm going to sort of shock because I feel in a sort of petulant mood or whatever. I think there has to be a bigger motive behind it, and that motive has to be to kind of represent the internal world of the character.
When you take on a project like this, and as I mentioned, the last book was in South Beach, and this book is back in Edinburgh. So will you continue on that? Will you continue writing about Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, I'll always write about Scotland. I mean, in some ways, it's like, you know, the more you move around, the more it becomes a kind of soup. I mean, everything influences you. But the bedrock for me is basically is always going to be Scotland, because that's where I grew up, you know, and that's where kind of, you know, friends and family and all that, they influence you more than anybody else. So Scotland, specifically kind of North Edinburgh and kind of Leith, Muirhouse, all the places that I grew up in are going to be the kind of the key kind of places to me. And even when I write about other places, I'm still drawing on the, you know, the characters and the people that I've met and known there and all that, you know. So it's always going to have a huge influence. But again, the more traveling you do, the more you move around and the more you live in different places, the more, you know, other places start to impact now as well. I mean, Chicago's having a big influence on me now. Miami's having a very big influence on me. So that's going to continue, I think.
When you look back, you mentioned writing the first book, and how did Trainspotting change you?
Well, I mean, it kind of it changed my life quite radically, obviously, because you know. I mean, almost instantly, I mean, maybe after, I say almost instantly, but after about 18 months, I suddenly, of the publication of the book, I suddenly had all this kind of fame and recognition. I had all this money that, you know, so I think that these were two things that I think anybody has to cope with. If you're unknown, you suddenly become famous, you know, you have that kind of thing. And I'd kind of more fame than writers normally have, because it's like it was a very kind of hip kind of youth culture kind of underground type book, so I had a kind of cool cachet that I probably didn't deserve, but I had anyway. And then there's money, basically. Suddenly when you've got money and you've got all these big checks coming in, you don't need to work, and you can indulge your hobby, basically, which is writing. That kind of changes your life, you know. So you have to learn how to operate with these two things, because, you know, it's just another thing that you have to kind of get used to. You know, that your life is going to be different. And sometimes, you know, and most of the time it's different for good in good ways, but other times it's different from bad ways. You do lose a little bit as well, but I think you gain much, much more than you lose.
The name of the book is A Decent Ride, and it is out from Doubleday. Evan Welsh, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program, as always.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to come on.
Again, Irvine Welsh's new novel is A Decent Ride. It is published by Doubleday. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.